You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Russ Whitehurst. I'm director of the Brown Center on Education Policy here at Brookings, and I will be presenting results today from the second annual Education Choice and Competition Index. So we'll start with crowd participation. How many of you think that K-12 U.S. education is in need of improvement? Wonderful. Well, I agree with you. We have very low high school graduation rates compared to the rest of the world, some hovering around 76%. We have low college completion rates. We have mediocre performance by U.S. students on international examinations, and we have among the highest cost for education in the world. So it sounds like to me there's some room for improvement in there somewhere, and I think there are three ways to think about improvement, at least from the 20,000-foot level. We can make our bet on top-down accountability. We've seen that under No Child Left Behind. I guess the idea is if we have a good enough accountability system, what we'll see is a standardization of schools so that every school will be sort of good enough in the way that almost every airplane you get on is good enough to get you where you're going, and that states and the U.S. federal government will be able to ensure that that happens. And that may be the case, but I think most observers would say that there's been at best modest progress from that kind of approach to education reform. And in fact, the sense of disappointment with it is leading Congress to say, well, maybe the next step should be to return control to states and local school districts. That was the status quo of the 1990s that led to the sense that something had to be done differently, which led to No Child Left Behind. I think there's a third way, and in a way that's what today's event is about. And the third way is to think about how the rest of our economy works, and to think about a system for K-12 education that's much like our system for post-secondary education, a system in which people shop for schools, they make choices, schools prosper or fail depending on their popularity, their ability to attract and retain students. We think that introducing choice and competition into K-12 education is a path that has not been taken except by a few places around the country, and we think it's promising. The Choice and Competition Index that we're releasing today is a result of some work done here now almost 4 years ago, where we assembled an expert panel of people around the country from a variety of fields, including a health economist. And the question was, if you were designing a choice system for public education, what would it look like? What would its desirable characteristics be? And we went from that to following the advice from that expert panel, and their advice was, well, now we've laid out a roadmap for you. Why don't you actually measure the extent to which school districts are doing this sort of thing? Last year, we released the first version of the index. The first iteration was only of 25 school districts. We've moved ahead this year to provide you information on 107 school districts around the country. If you choose to dig into the index, you'll see there's a lot of detail there. There are 13 categories on which we examine school districts, but there are four essential concepts that we're focusing on. What would it look like if the geographical area, the metropolitan area, served by public schools, what would it look like if they got a high score on our choice and competition index? Well, first, there would be lots of choice. So there would be regular public schools, open enrollment, so that students can get into those public schools. There would be magnet schools. There would be charter schools. There would be affordable private schools. There would be virtual education. And in some places, there would be private schools where attendance is supported by the public purse through through scholarships. So everywhere you look, there would be schools that would be open to almost every parent who had a school-age child in the district. Second, there would be good information. So if you're going to shop, it's good to know what you're shopping for. So rather than choosing blindly, parents would be able to get online or use paper and get good comparative information on all the schools that are available to them, not only on the standard achievement scores that we focus on today, but other things that parents care about and they talk about when they run into each other in the grocery store. You know, what's the principal like? You know, do they have a good band program? Things that are important to parents should be part of the information package that's available to them to support choice. Third overarching factor in our index is the choice architecture itself. Once you're going to express a choice, how do you do that? And it turns out the possibilities there are vast, and most of them are very poorly designed. Typically, even in a district that supports a lot of choice through magnet schools and charter schools, the process is a one-off in each of those schools. If you're a parent, you're interested in getting your child in that school, you go to that school, you get its application, you fill it out. If the school is oversubscribed, there's a lottery for that particular school. The admissions dates for that school may be different from another school. You're playing a system that's designed to make it extraordinarily difficult, particularly if you're uninformed about how it works in general, to exercise choice. Ideally, we want a common application. Apply once, express your preferences for all of the available schools, a common admissions date, and a piece of software that maximizes the match between what the parent has preferred and the schools to which that parent's child gains admission. And finally, in the overarching category, we're interested in money following students. So rather than school districts getting a big package of money that they get to decide where to disperse, perhaps as many districts do, just kind of spreading the money evenly among the schools in that jurisdiction, money will follow students to schools so that schools that gain in popularity, gain in enrollment, get more resources, and unpopular schools wither, just like the neighborhood restaurant that no longer serves meals anybody is willing to eat. So what I'll do now is I'll give you just a little teaser about the Education Choice and Competition Index that we released today. It is available online as an interactive website, so all I'm trying to do here is to increase your appetite for going online and playing with it and seeing what you can find there. And if you want to tweet about this, that's the hash for the for live tweeting, if you want to do that while I'm talking today. And the URL for the index itself is second on this page. Home page for the index, you'll see here that the winner this year is the Recovery School District, which serves New Orleans. And the Recovery School District, which was begun shortly after Katrina and really kicked into high gear about 5 years ago, has most, though not all, of the desirable characteristics of a geographical area with a high degree of choice. It's also worth noting that number six on our list, and by the way, this is just the top of the list. Again, there are 107 districts, so if you were online, you could scroll down. It's interesting to note that Orleans Parish is number six on our list. So the Recovery School District and Orleans Parish serve the same geographical area. They actually cooperate. There's a common application for high schools across those two different entities. It's an area that is well served by choice. You can drill down from here and get the information on any particular district. Again, this is the Recovery District in New Orleans. If you can see what is probably small print on your screen here, and if you can't, I'll talk to you about it. You'll see that the Recovery School District does particularly well on their assignment and application processes. Again, there's a common application, sophisticated computer algorithm that does matching. They're really good at shutting down low-performing schools. That's kind of been the business of the Recovery School District. Do a great job on transportation. If you're going to a school of choice that's not within walking distance in New Orleans, you get a token for the public transportation system, and the child can use that. You can drill down further and determine why each district got the particular score it did on each component. Here we're looking at the assignment mechanism, which we think is very important. There's an economist, Alvin Roth, who won the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics this year for figuring out how to design a choice architecture that provides the greatest, closest possible match between preference and outcome. And that's, in fact, incorporated in the software that the Recovery School District uses to generate assignments of students to schools. You can also print out or look at a district snapshot, which combines the most notable information in one place. If you go back to the main page, you can do something that we think is important for choosing schools if you're a parent, and so we incorporated it into this design for looking at districts, and that's to do side-by-side comparisons. Washington, D.C. is number 3 on our list this year. Recovery School District is number 1. How do they differ? We think there are interesting clues there to what districts might do who are a little further down on the list to raise their score in a subsequent year. And if you look carefully at this now or later on when it's available online, you'll see a clear difference between the Recovery School District and the District of Columbia is in the choice architecture. There are no default schools in the Recovery School District in Washington, D.C. You start with a default and you have to work your way out of it. The assignment mechanism is much better. Another way to access our information is through an interactive map. So you can go online and just click on the districts that you're interested in and essentially get the same information. If you clicked on the Recovery School District, you would access the information that's available here. So why do this? Why have choice? 4 reasons. One is that parents want it overwhelmingly. And middle-class parents exercise choice. They exercise choice by buying a home that's close to the public school to which their kids will be assigned. It's the poor and immobile parents who don't get to do that. And that's the second reason we think it's important to encourage choice, and that's equity. It doesn't feel right to me that I can choose to get my son in a good public school by moving to a district that provides such schools, but somebody with fewer resources. It's not even take it or leave it. There's no opportunity to leave it. Attendance at school is mandatory. It's just take it. This is where your child is going to go to school, whether it's a good performing school or not. That seems to me the height of inequity, something that we need to do something about. Third, we know that competition among schools improves performance just as it does competition among other entities. So the research is clear that schools that are subject to competition work to get better, and that's important. And finally, innovation, a kind of top-down accountability model that aims to produce kind of cookie-cutter schools in which each is good enough. To the degree that that model succeeds, what we have is a cookie-cutter approach. If you look at the sources of innovation in the public sphere or in the K-12 sphere over the last 15 years, they almost all have arisen in schools that are not subject to the demands of a central office. So whether it's longer school days, paying teachers more, the use of technology to change staffing patterns in schools, the ability to get minority children who would ordinarily be at the 10th percentile up to the 50th percentile, all of those innovations have come out of schools that are free to innovate. And a choice and competition environment is one that allows that kind of innovation to occur. So I invite you to take a look at the ECCI index online. And I will steal from my colleague here at Brookings a kind of phrase for how we want to characterize this approach. I'm not sure if Bill viewed it as a favorable phrase, but I do. And it's shop to the top. So let's free parents to shop for schools, and by so doing, create an environment of innovation and reform in American education. I'm not going to switch gears for you. It is my great pleasure to welcome back to Brookings Bobby Jindal, who is the 55th governor of the great state of Louisiana. Governor Jindal reminded me the last few times he was here, he was talking about health care, and I think this is the first time he's been here to talk about education. That's quite exciting. Just give you a little biographical background. He was born in Baton Rouge, went to the public high schools there, went on to Brown University, where he graduated with honors in public policy and biology. It just so happens that one of his former professors is here at Brookings, and I was checking up on the governor this morning to see how he actually did it at Brown, and the reputation was an absolutely brilliant student. He studied as a Rhodes Scholar, receiving Masters of Letters from Oxford in political science with a focus on health policy. At the age of 24, he was appointed Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals, which was responsible for 40% of the state's budget. And under Bobby Jindal's stewardship, that particular department went from a deficit to surplus at the same time. Access and performance increased dramatically. At age 28, and this begins for me a series of invidious personal comparisons, at age 28, when I had been just a beginning assistant professor for a couple of years, Bobby Jindal was president of the University of Louisiana system of higher education. He moved from there to Washington, where he started at about the same time I did as assistant secretary. He and Health and Human Services for planning and evaluation. Again, I view this as kind of a capstone of a long career. It was just a very early career success for the governor. He returned home to run for governor. He lost. It's the only thing in his whole bio I could find that would have been perhaps a visible disappointment. But then he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives. He won, came back home, ran for governor again, was elected to his first term in 2007, was reelected in 2011. Among his many positions of influence, he's the current chairman of the Republican Governors Association. So, as I indicated, he could be here talking about health care. He could be talking about energy policy. He could be talking about employment policy, all things which he has considerable expertise. But he's the perfect person for today's event because he's passionate and smart about education reform. He's also responsible for the Recovery School District, which was a creation of the state of Louisiana and which we've identified here today as the leading district in the nation. I was taken by words from Governor Jindal's inauguration speech of this year. He said, "In America, you do not have a right to have everything your neighbor has. You do not have a right to a big house or a fancy car, and you do not have a right to redistribute your neighbor's wealth. But I would suggest that we long ago decided that every kid does have a right to a quality education. They're not getting it now, and here's the good news. We can fix this. All we need is the willpower to get it done. The way forward is very simple. It is to provide more choices and more opportunities for parents, for families, and for children." I hope you will join me in welcoming Governor Bobby Jindal to the stage.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that very generous introduction. I want to thank you also for recognizing the tremendous work being done in New Orleans as well as across the state of Louisiana. You know, I'm going to start off by, and again, thank you again for the kind words about the reforms there. I'm going to start off by acknowledging some things hopefully everybody in this room already agrees upon, and I'm not even going to try to convince you of that. I'll start off by saying that we certainly have an economic and moral imperative to make sure that every child, not only in Louisiana, but in America, gets a great education. And hopefully everybody in this room already agrees with that statement. I'll also start off with a statement that we're not achieving that goal today in America. And the third thing I'd say is that it's not simply a matter of throwing more money at the problem. We already spend more than any other country other than Luxembourg, and yet we're not getting the results that our kids deserve in this great country. Now, as I was thinking about what I wanted to say today, a thought occurred to me that maybe I should start off by, you know, trying to say some things that you're not supposed to say in public. Maybe I should say those things that people think but don't like to say in polite company. And by the way, if you ever want to make your staff nervous, I can see them putting down their iPhones now and saying, what is he about to say? You might want to start off your remarks by saying you're going to say what folks don't want to say in public, but really you're thinking. Here it goes. And I'm going to talk in a little bit, in a few minutes, about New Orleans and what we're doing in Louisiana. But I want to start by sharing two what may be scandalous observations for you. First, the United States of America does not provide equal opportunity in education. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. This is a great country. We're blessed, I believe, to live in what I believe is the greatest country in the history of the world, but America does not provide equal opportunity in education. Yes, we are the land of the free, the home of the brave, and we can all take solace in that. But don't lay your head on your pillow tonight believing that we provide equal opportunity in education. We do not do that today. I'll grant you the original goal of public education in America was to provide a quality education for every child, regardless of circumstances, income, zip code, race, religion, or any other factors. And I'd suggest this worked pretty well for a long period of time. I'd also appreciate the nostalgic view that many people take towards public education in America. The notion that it is fair, that it gives the disadvantaged, the downtrodden a chance, an opportunity in life they otherwise wouldn't have. You know, with public education, it's not just the sons and daughters of the nobles who can be educated. The children of the serfs can be educated as well. I'll be the first to admit that was once true in our country. But it is completely dishonest to pretend today that America provides equal opportunity in education. We don't. And if you say that we do, you're lying. Though I'd love to be more direct, I don't know how I can be more direct. And this is a very, very important point. If you're a low-income parent residing in an urban area in America, it is more likely than not that your child attends a failing school. Unless you're fortunate enough to live in New Orleans or Milwaukee or Cleveland, you have no options, no recourse. You don't have the resources to enroll your child in a non-public school that is performing well. You don't have the resources to move your family to an area with higher performing public schools. That is just fact. Now, Russ talked about my inaugural speech. I actually said this to the audience then. I'll say it to the audience here today as well. For the folks hearing my remarks, chances are, if you have children, you'll do whatever it takes to make sure they get a great education. I'm willing to bet almost everybody here that has a child either lives in a neighborhood with great public schools or is saved in spending the resources to make sure their child goes to a great private school. The problem is there are too many families in Louisiana and America that don't have that opportunity today. My second scandalous observation is this. There is one entity working hard every day, spending millions of dollars every year to make sure you don't ever get the opportunity to get your child out of that failing school into a different school. And that entity is the teachers' union. That, my friends, is shameful. Were it not for the teachers' union's Herculean efforts, every low-income family would probably have the opportunity to enroll their child into a better-performing school, a school that meets the unique needs of their children. That's not an opinion, and that's a fact. It's a fact that teacher union officials don't even deny. In fact, they brag about it. They alone are stopping school choice from occurring all across this country. Now, to be fair, I believe the great majority of teachers in this country have very pure motives. I found teachers to be far more giving and compassionate and well-intentioned than the folks who populate most professions. Truth be told, our country would be royally off the rails without these people. I'm sure everybody here remembers that great teacher that made a difference in your life. Everybody here remembers that teacher. You wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for that teacher that took a special interest in you, that was harder on you, that made sure you achieved your potential. Furthermore, I believe we terribly undervalue teachers in this country. We demonstrate that by how we pay them all the same, how we jam them into a status system which places little value on quality and supreme value on longevity. I've said this before, and I get in trouble when I say it, but it's true. We should stop paying teachers based on how long they've been breathing and instead reward them for doing a great job in our classrooms. It's way past time for the rank-and-file teachers to peel the scales off of their eyes and realize that teachers' unions exist for their own benefit, not the benefit of teachers. It's time to look at what their union is doing and put an end to it. It is time to bring American education out of the Stone Age into the 21st century, a place where our choices are dramatically expanding, a place where the old centralized government model is increasingly outdated and inefficient. And I'll have more to say along these lines at the end of my remarks, but now that hopefully I've gotten your attention with those two observations, I want to talk to you a little bit more specifically about what's happening in Louisiana and New Orleans. And before I get into the details of what we did with our educational system, I want to start with a story that took place 10 years ago. You know, it's very fashionable to think that all of the problems in New Orleans and in Louisiana, especially in our educational system, started with Katrina and Rita. It's very easy. Now, Katrina and Rita were awful storms, caused massive devastation and loss of life. It's hard, if not impossible, to exaggerate the consequences to my state and to our people. But we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking everything was nirvana and everything was great pre-Katrina. You go back to 2003 into the New Orleans public school system. There was a valedictorian of a high school in New Orleans who wasn't allowed to attend her own graduation ceremony. She had terrific grades, valedictorian of her high school. She had the honor of being named the valedictorian. The problem was that she hadn't passed the 10th grade exit exam, even after taking it 5 times. She had only scored an 11 on the ACT. Now, to put that in perspective, that is 7 points below the score at which the ACT requires college remediation. This is the valedictorian of her high school. New Orleans at that time was a traditional district with school attendance zones that assigned students to school based on their zip codes, had an onerous and restrictive collective bargaining agreement with the local teachers' unions. 77% of students attended a failing school. This is pre-Katrina. Back in 2003, that same year, the Recovery School District was actually created by the state. It was a statewide, state-run district. Its purpose is to take over schools after 4 years of failure and turn them around. When it was created, I don't think anybody could have imagined how important it was going to be to transform New Orleans or how it was going to inspire reform statewide. Those first few years, simply 5 schools in New Orleans were transferred to the RSD. You fast forward to 2005. Hurricanes Katrina and Rita decimated the city and our school's infrastructure. Out of necessity, the legislature convened an emergency session in the fall of 2005, gave 107 low-performing schools in the city over to the RSD. It's kind of like the proverbial dog chasing the car. So after all these years, the reformers, the leaders said, we want a chance to turn around these schools. Now they were given that chance. State quickly realized it couldn't do this alone. The Orleans Parish School Board just simply wasn't functioning. Most of the buildings were severely damaged. There were no basic supplies like pencils and paper. We needed help, and we needed it badly. We needed problem solvers. We needed innovators. We needed leaders to come in and run some of these schools and turn them around. And they came from inside and outside the system, from the Ninth Ward and across the country. In fact, if you talk to some of the biggest proponents of the RSD today, they're actually the veteran teachers and principals who actually taught in that system before the storm. Take Sharon Clark, for example. She's the principal of Sophie B. Wright Charter School in New Orleans. She's been the principal since 2001, pre-Katrina, pre-Rita, pre-RSD. Before the storm, when she needed pens for her students, she had to hammer the district for months. She'd call and call and call the central office, no pens would ever show up. With that kind of bureaucracy, it's no wonder that only 20% of her students were on grade level. How do you focus on educating kids when the central office is distracting with all that kind of nonsense? In 2005, the school was converted to a charter. By her own words, Sharon was skeptical of this new model that exchanged autonomy for accountability. She didn't go in thinking this was the answer to her problem. She didn't go in thinking this was the solution. But ask her today what she would do if Sophie B. Wright weren't an RSD charter, and she says this, she would find another profession. That's because when she needs pens now, she literally walks down the street to Staples and she buys them. 54% of her students now at the school are on grade level. It's not enough, but despite the gains we've made, we started from such low standards and achievement levels, we were losing a generation of students. Public schools were improving at rates that defied imagination, but still too many students weren't on grade level. So we had this situation, we had awful schools before Katrina and Rita. The RSD has come in, we've got this tremendous gain, but we're still not where we need to be. And at the same time, you've got all these students not on grade level. Sitting next to them are great private schools that these students couldn't afford to attend. So we turned again to folks outside the traditional public education world in 2008. We created the New Orleans Scholarship Program. Why wouldn't we give them the choice with their parents' own tax dollars, after all, to pick the better option next door? These kids simply had no time to lose. And I get so frustrated when people tell you, don't worry, we're making great incremental progress. Many people pointed to the success of RSD and said, things are going great. We said, these children only have one chance to grow up. We can't make incremental progress. We've got to give them a great education now. That first year, 600 students enrolled in a private school on a scholarship. Today, there are 86 public schools currently open in New Orleans serving approximately 38,000 students. 43 private schools in and around the city are in the scholarship program serving nearly 3,000. Take the example of Valerie Evans. The scholarship program totally changed everything for her son, Gabriel. Returning after the storm, Gabriel was way behind academically. He had essentially missed an entire year of school after the storm. Returning home, he was being bullied in the traditional New Orleans public school where he was enrolled. According to his mother, Valerie, she said this, "He used to cry not to go to school." When a volunteer came and knocked on her door in the summer of 2008, she eagerly applied for a scholarship, and Gabriel got a spot at Resurrection of Our Lord Elementary in the third grade. She says this, "I couldn't send him back to that dangerous environment he had been in where he wasn't catching up academically and he was coming home crying," she explains. Now he's 11. She says Gabriel is happy, well-adjusted, he's on track to enter a college prep program and then ultimately college. If Valerie had her way, every parent would have the opportunity to make the same choice she did. In 2012, parents in New Orleans do, and the results speak of themselves. 78% of our students in New Orleans are now enrolled in charter schools. Only 29% of students are now in a failing school, even while we've raised academic standards statewide. You compare that to 2005. 77% of New Orleans students in 2005 attended a failing school. Since 2007, the last 5 years alone, the percentage of students in New Orleans that are reading and doing math at grade level has more than doubled. And I want you to think about that, because so often people will tell you, we can't solve these problems. It's going to take decades. There's no way that you're going to be able to make these kinds of improvements this quickly. You'd never thought before the storm we'd be here today. Who would have predicted back in 2003 we'd be here today to recognize New Orleans as the number one ranked school district on the Brookings Choice and Competition Index? As Russ mentioned earlier, it's the first and only district to receive a grade of A for its competitive environment. And truly, New Orleans is the highest standard of choice. No child is stuck in the school that happens to be in his zip code. No child is priced out of a better private option, and student achievement is on the rise. The bottom line is there's no such thing as a quality monopoly. Quality is driven by competition, accountability, and autonomy. Let providers compete, hold them accountable for outcomes, but get out of the way and let teachers and school leaders do their jobs. And let me tell you a little bit about how it works in New Orleans. Students apply to a single central enrollment system that includes schools citywide, the Orleans Parish School Board schools, RSD schools, scholarship program schools, locally authorized charter schools, and state authorized charter schools. That student ranks his school choices, public or private, all in one application. He's placed by a lottery that prioritizes, above all, the school he ranked as his top choice. There's no default option. Even a parent who wants the local neighborhood school down the block, the one the old attendance zones would have picked for her child, must choose it. The bottom line is we got over ourselves. The government doesn't have a monopoly on education. As a matter of fact, it really doesn't matter who runs the schools or oversees it if it's offering a high-quality education. A student can choose it, and we will pay for them to do so. The dollars follow the child instead of making the child follow the dollars to the school that he chooses, while parents receive transparent, easy-to-understand information about school performance to help them choose wisely. Again, the results speak for themselves. Between 2008 and 2012, the RSD in New Orleans had the highest growth of any district in the state, a nearly 50% increase. In 2012, the Orleans Parish School Board got an A with the second highest performance in the state. The scholarship schools are showing significantly more growth since 2008 than schools statewide. While the state grew 2 points in the percentage of proficient third graders in math, the scholarship program grew 23 percentage points. While the state grew 3 points in the percentage of proficient third graders in English, the scholarship program students grew 12 percentage points. The RSD was the model. Now it was time to give these same choices to every parent in the state. We knew we had a lot of quality providers already in Louisiana. Traditional public schools, charter schools, private schools, virtual schools, colleges offering dual enrollment, and business and industry offering technical training. In 2009, we removed the cap on charter schools. This year, 104 charter schools are educating nearly 57,000 students in Louisiana. Just this last year alone, charter schools outpaced district schools in raising student achievement, 6.14 points versus 4.7 points of growth. Over the last 5 years, we've also added nearly 1,000 seats to the Louisiana Virtual School and 20 additional course offerings. As a result, we were able to expand advanced placement courses to every parish. Today, every district is required to offer at least one AP course, and the research shows AP improves college achievement. UT researchers concluded students taking AP courses in high school are more likely to graduate from college within 4 years and have higher GPAs in college than similar students who didn't take AP courses. In 2011, we created the ultimate tool to empower parents. We translated school performance into letter grades. No longer could our schools hide from how many failing, no longer could any district hide from how many failing schools we have. But the different choices weren't always easy to use. They had different funding streams and different application processes. It was hard for parents to know which choices they had or to access them. So we passed legislation last spring that turned our various choices into a system by doing five things. First, we expanded the scholarship program to all 64 parishes in Louisiana for low-income students. Louisiana already has one of the highest private school attendance rates in the country, yet the poorest students were priced out of this option. Now, any student at a C, D, or F-rated school can attend the private school of his choice. 117 private schools signed up this first year, and still demand exceeded supply. There were 10,000 students applying for 5,000 spots. The number of scholarships awarded this year because of our reforms increased by 250% over last year. And we hold these schools accountable for getting the job done. Scholarship students take state tests, and those results are reported each year. For scholarship students, schools receive a scholarship cohort index, a calculation similar to the public school's school performance scores that give parents a clear picture of how scholarship students at that school are doing. If the scholarship school receives a score of 50 or below on a scale of 150, the same failing bar for public schools, whose SPS is also calculated on a 150-point scale, after 2 years, we won't give them any more students till they can demonstrate improvement. If they get multiple years of a failing score, we can kick them out of the program permanently unless they show significant growth or at least that they are doing better than the public schools where their students would otherwise attend. Secondly, we created new pathways to become a charter school. Before this legislation, there was only one way to become a charter school. Operators had to apply one school at a time, pushing paper instead of quality. Local leaders didn't have a way to help expand charters in their communities, especially in northern Louisiana, many hours from Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Now applicants in D and F districts can go straight to the state board. Charters with track records in other states can get credit for that performance. High-performing charters can receive performance-based approval for more than one school in the same application cycle, where the opening of the second school is based on the successful performance of the first school, the third school on the performance of the first two, and so on, to achieve economies of scale for operators. And we also created a new kind of authorizer to empower local communities to engage in charter schools, but to keep the level of quality and accountability we see with state-authorized schools by letting our state board create local franchises of itself. The state board will approve in a charter-like process an interested, well-established nonprofit or university that has the capacity, controls, and wherewithal to authorize charter schools. We had to deal with reality. Charters were not going to expand in northern Louisiana unless we engaged the communities to invest in the schools themselves. But we set the bar high. If after 4 years the schools this entity authorized were on average rated a D or F, the state would take them over and the organization would lose its certification to open more schools. If they rated a C on average, the entity would be prohibited from opening more schools until the performance improved. We also created the Business Charter Partnership to provide incentives for a business or group of businesses to participate in the development of high-quality charter schools. This partnership is a benefit for economic development and public education in three ways. It empowers communities looking for a way to attract businesses to their parishes. It gives school districts, which can also authorize charter schools, a way to involve the business community in public education. And it provides charter schools a new tool to address facility concerns. The third thing we did is we created choice not only at the school level, but at the course level as well. These new course providers are universities, virtual providers, even business and industry that apply to our state board like charter schools do to be approved to offer coursework for credit. Before, organizations like the Associated Builders and Contractors would offer nationally accredited welding classes after hours on high school campuses, but students couldn't get Louisiana credit for them. They'd have to take a second, typically lower quality welding class during the school day. Students who lived in rural districts that didn't have the resources to hire an AP biology teacher were stuck. Students in those districts just didn't have access to that kind of advanced coursework. With Course Choice, we created a way for quality non-traditional providers to offer advanced technical and virtual content during the school day for school credit and across the state. And we implemented a pay-for-performance market-based model. The course provider sets its own tuition up to a cap worth a sixth of 90% of the per-student amount. If they want to be competitive, they can charge lower amounts, meaning for the same dollars we can offer more education. But the student has to finish the class. The provider gets paid half up front and half when the student finishes the course. If they can get the student to re-enroll after dropping out, they'll get 40% and the district 10% as an incentive to keep the library open after hours or to give the student more flexibility on his course schedule to make it open. In other words, we're prioritizing successful completion of the course, not just paying for activity. Fourth, we gave parents a way to speed up reform by creating a parent trigger that will authorize transfer to the RSD after 3 instead of 4 years of failing with a petition of the state board from a majority of parents. It also gave this authority to parents at D or F schools, not just F schools under the old rules. Parents should be able to trigger change, not have to move to another town or pay for private school to see reforms in their local school. But there was one reform that was absolutely critical. We have changed how we fund all of this. Instead of a disjointed system where all these choices were siloed, confusing to access, and funded by different funding streams in the complex web of government dollars, we said this. First, all of this should be in our state funding formula. Second, dollars should follow the child. And third, superintendents and principals should have control over the biggest cost driver of district budgets, personnel. Historically, in Louisiana, like other states, K-12 education spending is considered an entitlement to school districts. They think it's their money. You know, the reality is it's not their money. It's taxpayers' money. It's the money of the single mom who wants better for her son in a private school. It's the money of the parents with a talented science student who wants to take AP courses. It's the money of the grandmother who wants to make sure her special education grandbaby gets the services she needs. The teachers' unions wouldn't stand for this. They sued us, saying that our state funding formula was only for public schools. I leave the legal arguments to the lawyers, but I thought the Wall Street Journal put it best. They said the judge conceded that scholarships are intended to help students escape awful schools. But he said this ignores the good of the individual students who are left behind in those schools deemed underperforming. In other words, as the editorial board of the journal wrote, better that all students fail together rather than let parents take the money that is supposed to go to public education and try to get their child actually educated. The Wall Street Journal said this is the kind of reverse egalitarianism promoted by the teachers' unions that brought the lawsuit. And I couldn't agree with that anymore. My job is to make sure that every child has the opportunity to get a great education. We're taking our fight to the state Supreme Court, and I'm confident that we'll prevail. Well, how do you do this? Three ways. First, you've got to pay for what you want. We don't want D and F schools. We want quality education, whether that's public, charter, private, virtual school, whether it's all at one place, several places, regardless of where that child happens to live. Secondly, we must open the market to innovation. Education reform is hard. We should be inviting anybody who can help to get the job done to the table, not sticking to traditional definitions of what a school looks like and who can be teachers. If you can demonstrate you can get the job done, we want you in our system. Third, we've got to put reform in the system, not on top of it. Reform is not an add-on. If you want structural change, you have to stick what you want into the structure. Stop funding charter schools and scholarships on top of the traditional system. Start funding the whole system of choice. Empower parents to really vote with their feet without having to sell their house to pay for private school. Ironically, federal funding hasn't gotten the memo. While Louisiana is funding children with a portable, flexible financial backpack, the big entitlement programs like Title I and IDEA are still funding programs and buildings. Federal dollars need an update to fund children, not concrete. We can't manage schools from Washington or Baton Rouge, and we shouldn't try. We need to empower the people closest to students and have dollars follow a child to the choice that's right for him. The bottom line is these reforms work for students. Just a few selected facts from Louisiana. In 2010, half of our schools would have been considered a D or F. In 2012, 36% of our schools are now receiving a D or F. The number of schools earning an A rose from 98 in 2011 to 163 in 2012, a 66% increase. Our cohort dropout rate has decreased from 17 to 14.6% over the last year. That's a 4-point decrease since 2008. We certainly have more work to do. Nobody can take solace in those numbers, but we are headed in the right direction. Now, as I conclude this speech, I want to be certain that I leave no ambiguity with regard to where I stand. I don't accept the notion that equal opportunity in education should be a partisan issue. I did serve in Congress for a few years, and I realize in the realm of politics, everything at one time or another becomes a partisan issue. Such is the nature of our competitive system of government. It's completely legitimate to note that two parties have differing views with regard to education policy, and I'm sure that will forever be the case. But partisan issues tend to never get resolved, and America cannot afford to leave these matters unresolved. It is no overstatement to state the future health of our nation rests on it. But there are some issues, important issues in our country, which aren't partisan at all, things that nearly every American agrees upon. For example, I think we all agree that we need a military that is strong enough to defend us against those who wish to do us harm. It's not a partisan issue. That's a consensus issue. I think we all agree that we needed to rid the world of bin Laden. That wasn't a partisan issue. It was a consensus viewpoint. We all agreed we need a federal highway system. Again, it's not a partisan issue. Almost everybody agrees with that. These issues are consensus issues. I believe that equal opportunity in education, made real by school choice, should be a similarly nonpartisan consensus issue. There's always going to be debate over the specifics, but the basic principle should really not be contentious at all. I mean, do we really even need to argue about whether our current antiquated system is working? Like I said at the beginning of the talk, I don't see any need to drag you through the many statistics showing America's slide in comparison to other industrialized countries. You're already familiar with the data. Neither should equal opportunity in education be considered an ideological issue. Many people who call themselves ideological liberals agree with me on this issue, or if you prefer, I agree with them on this issue. Either way is fine with me. Equal opportunity in education shouldn't be a conservative position, a liberal position, should be an American position. And the ultimate irony here is this. The people who are in charge of our education system, these are people you'd hope or think or want to believe, are themselves capable of critical thought, of change, of learning, of adapting. It's not hard. This is, I was saying to Russ, it's simple math. We are losing ground. We must adapt. We must change. We have to. How can it be that America, the country with the greatest higher educational opportunities in the entire world, the country that houses the universities that help to educate the world, can be so stuck in the Stone Age when it comes to pre-K through 12 education? It almost seems laughable, and it would be were it not for the seriousness of the situation. The old way, the centralized government way, is just not relevant to the modern world, the media age, the social media age, the internet age, the technology age. And that's where we are now. The old top-down way doesn't work anymore. We must move to a bottom-up, organic way of operating, and education is the tip of the spear. I'd like to close by leaving you with three hard truths that must be faced up to sooner or later. I started with two uncomfortable observations, three hard truths. First, to oppose school choice is to choose an old, antiquated, centralized approach that is not working and has no relevance to the modern digital age. Secondly, to oppose school choice is to put the wishes of the adults who control the status quo ahead of the needs of our children. And third and finally this, to oppose school choice is to oppose equal opportunity for poor and disadvantaged children in America. It is my sincere hope that what we are now putting in motion in Louisiana can be done across the country. I believe we've got an economic and a moral imperative to provide school choice and a quality education to every child, every student in America. In that case, many lives will be transformed, many futures will be realized, and the results for all our country will be real and lasting. And the reason I'm so passionate about this is we live in an aspirational society. American dream is the circumstances of your birth don't determine your outcomes as an adult. We've all grown up hearing that from our parents. If you work hard enough, there's no limit to what you can accomplish. How many times have parents told their children, you could be the next president of the United States. You could start your own company. You could become a doctor, a teacher, a lawyer. You could run your own business. The reality is we believe that our children should have the opportunity to do better than their parents. For that American dream to be true, however, it starts with providing every child a great education. If we really believe that a child's zip code, race, gender, parents' wealth don't determine how well they're going to do as adults, we've got to make sure they get a great education so they can compete in today's global economy. Thank you again for having me. Thank you to the Brookings Institution, not only for the recognition today, but for all the great work you do on education and several other issues as well. Thank you all very much for having me.
Well, thank you very much. That was exciting. I'm trying to find some things to disagree with you on. I'll have to keep working on it, I think. Let me ask you a broad question. We've just had a presidential election. The candidates had positions on education, though they didn't come to the fore. I think there's a broad issue about what should the federal role be in reform. And so, were you running for president, or were you advising someone who was running for president? What do you think the ideal federal role is vis-a-vis the state, local role, and the parental choice role?
Well, first of all, I'd a couple of observations. One, I do want to say this. It is no secret that I have disagreed with President Obama on several policies. And what may be more remarkable is I find many areas where I actually agree with what Arne Duncan is trying to do and what the president has tried to do in some areas of education reform. I don't think they go far enough, and I'm certainly disappointed. The president has opposed choice here in D.C. and in other parts of the country. But when you look at Arne's support personally before he was named secretary and the administration's general support for accountability, for example, tying the performance ratings, evaluations of teachers to student achievement, their support for charter schools, I think that they should be applauded for that. And as a Republican governor, I want to say that, again, I don't agree with them on everything. I'd like them to go further, but I certainly think there are things that they've supported that I certainly agree with, and I think that it shows this shouldn't be strictly a Republican or Democratic issue. Now, I come from a school of thought that this should not be led largely by the federal government, that education reform should be led at the local and the state level. The reality is that states, one, I mentioned there's a moral imperative to educate all of our children. There's also a practical economic imperative. 70% of the companies moving to or wanting to come to Louisiana that are expanding tell us one of their top two concerns is finding a skilled worker. Louisiana's economy has done better than the southern economy and the national economy during the national recession. We've cut taxes, cut government spending, invested in workforce training, revamped our ethics laws. Yet we also know this. Going forward, the states that are going to be successful will be the states with the most educated, skilled, productive populations. And so I think governors and I think local communities have all the motivation they need to try to improve their educational systems. I'm not personally a fan of the No Child Left Behind Act. I'm not a fan of top-down bureaucratic attempts from Washington, D.C. I think that the kinds of reforms you see in the RSD, the kinds of reforms you see in New Orleans and now in Louisiana work better when they're supported at the local level. Now, what we have done as a state, Louisiana has joined. We're one of 45 states that has joined to the Common Core curriculum that was developed, again, from the bottom up through the NGA. And we are implementing, phasing in, as this curriculum is rolled out, we're phasing in standardized tests across our schools. And so these will be content year-end tests based on these national curriculum standards. And I think that's a good thing. Because at the end of the day, I've got to compare Louisiana's kids. We need to compare what we're learning, not just to kids in Texas and Georgia, but we got to be able to compete with kids in Japan and South Korea and Brazil and other countries, because increasingly the companies that are investing in my state, I'll give you a couple of recent examples. Nucor is investing billions of dollars to build a steel mill in Louisiana. Their final two choices were Brazil and St. James Parish, Louisiana. And so we weren't just competing with the states around us. Sasol is building a multi-billion-dollar complex in Westlake, Louisiana, over a $20 billion investment. They were looking at other countries, not just other states. So even though I'm certainly for standards and I'm certainly for accountability, I don't think these need to come out of Washington, D.C. I think that public school policymaking, public school responsibility has traditionally been, K-12 education has traditionally been a responsibility of local and state government, and I think that should continue to be the case.
What work do you think is left to do in Louisiana?
I think there's a tremendous amount of work to do in Louisiana. You know, you start in New Orleans and you look in across the state. I think we are just now, we just put out to bid these course providers. We've got about 48 qualified respondents. We had many more than that. The Bessie Board has narrowed it down to about 48 providers, including, for example, every public university in the state, as well as a number of other content providers. And so we are just now about to implement that. I want you to think about how exciting that is. Let's say your child is going to a failing school. Let's say you're in a low-income family. For years, you've been trapped by the course offerings at that school. Now, without even leaving that school, you have access to maybe the best biology teacher online. Maybe your child can take that AP course. Maybe your child wants to take a dual enrollment course before they leave high school. Maybe they want to be certified in welding. We've got a tremendous number of jobs requiring skilled workers across this country, and we've gotten away as a country from putting enough of an emphasis on community and technical college training. Maybe your child wants to take that course before they leave high school for an employer that's willing to hire them. Maybe your child wants to take some advanced college courses so they can earn college credit before they get to college. So one of the most exciting things, and you know, it gets overshadowed by the scholarship debate, it gets overshadowed by the tenure reforms, both of which were really, really important in last year's session. One of the most exciting reforms coming in Louisiana are these course selection providers that's going to open up the doors for education. And by the way, the same thing is happening in higher education as well. You see more and more content going online, and you see technology changing the way we're delivering instruction across higher education as well. So I think one big development statewide is the development of the course selection. Secondly, we've seen a lot of choice in New Orleans from charter schools. 78% of the kids are in charter schools. The scholarship program has been there since 2008. That's just now happening across the rest of the state. One of the reasons we opened up additional charter authorizers was that even though there was a state law requiring districts to have a process to approve charters, many of them simply didn't have a process. It's not that they turned them down. They didn't even have a process to apply for a charter school, and there was no consequence to that. And so now you're going to see meaningful choice and meaningful competition, not just in the urban areas, but across the state as well. So I think the third and final thing that I'm very excited about is that we are changing the way that we are evaluating and rewarding teachers. That system is in effect this year, but it really, the consequences will start next year, if you will. And what that means is we're doing a value-added assessment. We look at how the kids were doing at the beginning of the school year. We'll compare that at the end of the school year. Now we link our hiring, firing, compensation decisions to that growth in student achievement. So think about that. We're actually going to reward excellence in teaching in our classrooms. To me, you know, teachers are some of the most underappreciated professionals in the way that we've treated them today. We're literally today, it's just been how long they've been in the classroom, not how effective they've been. No wonder so many teachers get frustrated with that system. So we've done a lot of things, but there's a lot more change coming. And to me, this is a constant, you're never done in improving your school system. As we make these reforms, other states are going to, I'm sure, make reforms we're going to want to learn from. We owe a debt of gratitude to other states that came before us. We did letter grades. Florida had done letter grades before us. You know, Milwaukee was one of the pioneers in school choice. I believe our system is the most comprehensive system. We put all these pieces together, and we've gone farther than others. We've got a school rebate. One of the things I didn't talk about was a tax rebate for school tuition organizations. Florida does that as well. And I believe there'll be other states that will be adopting new reforms, and we're going to learn from them as well. And so one of the neat things is, as we progress, it's a friendly competition. And that's why I think it's great that it's happening at the local, at the state level, because as they learn and they adapt and they do innovative things, we're going to learn from them. And we'll. I don't think you can ever pass a set of laws and say you're done improving your schools.
Thank you. I'm going to open the floor to questions. I would ask when I call on you, raise your hand. Someone will bring you a microphone. Stand up. Tell us who you are. Try to keep your question a question and kind of short rather than a long disquisition. So call on this gentleman.
Hello. Thank you, Governor Jindal. My name is Jay Kansara. I'm with the Hindu American Foundation. My question is, you often cite the statistics that American students are doing much worse than students from other countries. So what are other countries doing that America could improve from, and do they have such a voucher system, and what do other countries think of the potential of a voucher system, and why haven't we already implemented what the other countries are already doing?
Sure. Well, three things. One, it's very important we benchmark ourselves to other countries because we're going to have to compete for them economically and otherwise. But I think it's also important to notice the difference as well. There are things that are unique to America that are great about America. For example, it's not true in every country that every child's afforded the ability to continue their education in subsequent years. And so certainly I think it's noteworthy that, for example, our scores are lower than in some instances when you look at standardized test results in China, for example. But it's also not true that we are comparing our test scores to the test scores for every Chinese student. That is a select group of students in China that's afforded those educational opportunities that has taken those tests. And that's true in many countries, not just China, but in many industrialized countries, there's earlier tracking of student achievement. So that at an earlier age, they will determine whether a child will go on to college or go on to certain types of advanced education. We don't do that in America, and I think that's a good thing. I think that we've got the belief that we're going to provide a public education and we're going to provide a high-quality education to every child in America. And so we're testing a broader array of our population, and that's a very good thing. I don't want to get to the point where we're just saying, I don't ever want us to take comfort in the fact that we say, oh, you know what, it's a great thing that our highest-performing students are doing better than their highest-performing students, because that doesn't tell the whole picture. I mean, it's very easy, if you want to take comfort in the fact we're 17th and 25th in science and math, to say, well, if you take the kids at our magnet schools and our selective admission schools, we do pretty well. Well, that's not really, that shouldn't be good enough for America. The second point I would make is some of the things we can learn from what other countries are doing. You look at, for example, the fact that the way that they look at teacher preparation in this country for too long, it's my belief that we put too much of an emphasis on inputs and not outputs, put too much of an emphasis on pieces of paper to measure teacher quality, and so we give bonuses for teachers that complete coursework, and we don't always tie that coursework to student achievement. And other countries have done a better job looking, for example, at alternative certifications. They've done a better job of looking at content-specific teachers. So, for example, there is good research showing that a teacher with a science, math, or content-specific education does a better job teaching students in those areas and maybe does a better job than just getting a certificate in an unrelated area. And so, secondly, the way that we train and prepare our teachers, I think we can learn, right, in terms of how they link it to student achievement, how they're rigorously looking for alternative certifications so that in other countries, in certain other countries, you know, it is not as unusual for second career, you know, for engineers to go in the teaching profession or for others to go Part of that goes back to compensation, though. I think we should be paying our teachers more. And again, I think when you're evaluating teachers, you've got the ability to put more resources in compensation. Third, you look at some of the things that have come and gone in America. We seem to choose different fads. At one point, it was all about classroom size, and so we had smaller classrooms. Then it was about lengthening the school day and lengthening the school year. And those may not be good or bad things. And some of those we've learned from other countries. Other countries, some of them have longer school days and school years. Some of them have smaller or larger classroom sizes. But what we haven't done consistently is rigorously test that in terms of saying, all right, what is that impact on student achievement? We shouldn't do it just because it sounds good. Maybe giving every student a laptop is a great idea. Maybe it's a bad idea, but we should do that based on actual student outcomes, not just based on the fact that it's the idea of the day. And so other countries, I think, have been more rigorous. Some other countries. I don't want to generalize. I mean, I don't want to say every other country, but there have been other countries that have been more rigorous in figuring out, is student class size really determinative? Is the teacher-student ratio? Or one of the things you are seeing from the data today, that if you had to choose, and you shouldn't have to choose, but if you had to choose between smaller class size or having more students in a larger class with a much better teacher, you're better off having the much better teacher. That just putting fewer kids in a classroom with a mediocre teacher is not helping student achievement. So part of it, I think, is being more rigorous. Now, again, you shouldn't have to choose. Ideally, you could have both, smaller class sizes and great teachers. But if you have to choose, you'd rather have the great teacher. So part of it is using the latest data and analysis to drive what we do. But fundamentally, we're going to solve this in an American way. Fundamentally, we're going to educate all of our children. And fundamentally, we're going to say, you know what, monopolies, that's not what works in America. We don't think that monopolies make sense in America. We've got, and by the way, and I promise I'll make the answer shorter. You ask for a shorter question, I'll give you shorter answers. One of the things that's different in Louisiana is, you know, we've got a tradition before school choice. We had a tradition of having one of the highest percentage of our students going to non-public schools already. In large part, not only, but in large part because of a historic presence of parochial schools, especially in southeast Louisiana, but not only because of that. But that's one of the things that's not unique, but it is special about Louisiana. Every state's different. And that's why I would say that I'm not here to tell you the answer is every state should go out there and do charter schools in every block, or that every state should put all their kids in parochial schools, or that every state should do online schools. What I'm saying is let competition and choice work. Let the dollars follow the students, measure the outcomes, and the solution that makes the best sense for your district and your state will emerge within Louisiana. There are going to be school districts where all the kids are going to go to traditional public schools and do extremely well. And there are going to be other districts where the kids are going to go to all, you know, a lot of them are going to go to charter schools, and that's a great thing. There's no one silver bullet. It's about choice and competition driving student excellence.
Here.
Hi, thanks for speaking. My name is Joy Resmovitz, and I cover education for the Huffington Post. A few minutes ago, you said that you're confident that the voucher case would go your way at the state Supreme Court. So I was wondering, first of all, what makes you confident? What happens if it doesn't? And do you think the center is shifting on the voucher issue nationally?
A couple of things. I am confident, and again, that's just... To me, it's pretty obvious that we don't fund bricks and mortars. We're funding students' education. And I'll leave the legal arguments to the lawyers. I'm not a lawyer, and I'll let them make their arguments in front of the state court. I want to remind folks, people like to view the scholarship debate as a partisan debate. We had nearly half the Senate Democrats and nearly a quarter of the House Democrats vote for our educational reforms. So this was a bipartisan effort. This wasn't just a Republican majority that voted for these reforms. This was a bipartisan effort that led to all of these, the reform bills that I've talked about today. So we're extremely confident that the state Supreme Court will understand that this is about funding children's education. It's not about taking opportunity away from 5,000 kids whose parents decided who picked their schools for them this school year. You look at the results in the New Orleans pilot program, I cited some statistics showing you academically they're doing well. Well over 90% of the parents are satisfied with that. You look at the cost, and we are saving millions of dollars for Louisiana taxpayers. Roughly speaking, we spend roughly $8,500, and I'm not counting a lot of dollars, but if you look at through the MFP, roughly $8,500 total dollars per student in public education in Louisiana. The average scholarship's roughly $5,300 per student. So we're actually saving taxpayers millions of dollars while providing a better education, and parents are happy with this solution. So to me, this is a win-win-win, and it's clearly legal, and clearly the intent in the Constitution is that we fund children's education, not bricks and mortars, and something we've been doing for many years, by the way. In terms of the center shifting, I would hope so. I did start off by saying that I happen to agree with some of the reforms, and I want to praise publicly Secretary Duncan. And I've jokingly told him this several times throughout the years that I don't want to get him in trouble with his boss. So if it's not helpful for me to say good things, I'll be happy to criticize him if that'd be better for his job security, because I know that they're selecting the cabinet for the second term. But I actually think, you know, he has actually been somebody who's been willing to work with us, listen to us. Don't agree with every decision he's made, but he is somebody that we've actually worked with. I'd like to believe the center was moving on scholarship and choice, but two things give me concern. One, the fact that despite all the areas where we agree with them on, that they still did fight the D.C. choice program, and it was something that the Speaker had to forcefully, that the House Republicans had to fight to preserve, just to keep a program in place that, by the way, was federal funding outside the D.C. school system for those scholarships. And then secondly, I don't see any signs the teacher unions have shifted on this. In Louisiana, we actually had a leader in the teachers' unions say that parents, poor parents, don't have a clue when it comes to making choices for their children. To me, that's appalling. And to me, that's the exact opposite of what I believe about education. I don't think it's top-down. I think parents make decisions for their kids every day, and I think they know their kids better than the bureaucrats in Baton Rouge or Washington, D.C. So I hope it's shifting. I'd like to believe it was shifting. I don't see signs of it yet, but I think what's going to happen, though, as it takes root, I think you're going to have more and more constituents for it. You're going to have more and more families. The best advocate for a scholarship and choice-based program is not me. It's the mom going to the table saying, I'm working two jobs. I'm following the rules. I want my child to do better. Look at me and tell me why it's wrong for my child to get a great education when your children are getting a great education. To me, that's pretty compelling. And that's the testimony that I think will allow these programs to grow. It's the parents going to the table and legislators across the country fighting for their children.
Back here. Gentleman in the fourth row. Yes, your hand's up.
Thank you. My name is Mark Nadell. I have a question about R&D and a possible federal role. You didn't mention Race to the Top. Most industries invest substantial amounts in R&D. I'm sure you're familiar with healthcare, whatever. Most experts in education have been very critical of the education sector, tiny amounts on R&D. Do you think Race to the Top and other federal role in funding R&D is a good role, or do you think states and local governments should be funding R&D, and if so, are you doing that?
Sure, two things. One, I would differentiate Race to the Top from R&D. Look, I'm not a big fan of the federal government playing such a big role in K-12 education, but to the extent they are going to spend those dollars, I think Race to the Top's a better way of doing it than simply just spreading the dollars out equally. So, for example, some Republicans did not participate. We did participate. Now, we didn't participate in every competition for Race. We looked at the rules for each different competition and program to see what made sense for us and which didn't. Some we thought were too paperwork heavy and some we thought were appropriate. And we did compete in some of those rounds. So, again, I don't like the fact the federal government's spending all this money. If it is going to spend this money, I think Race to the Top is better than just saying we're going to do it purely per student. We're simply going to throw the money out. Then all you're doing is taking the state's money and giving it back to them. I don't see the point in that. I would differentiate that from an R&D role. I do think there's an appropriate R&D role. Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, I talked earlier to the first question about we do need rigorous evaluation. We do need, and I think there is a very appropriate role. For example, you can imagine the National Academies of Science or NSF or other institutes sponsoring good research, testing the rigor of our value-added assessment systems. I think that's absolutely critical. If we're going to put a lot of emphasis on rewarding teachers based on how well students are doing, we better make sure we've got rigorous evaluation. And by the way, in Louisiana, we link those evaluation systems to our colleges of education as well. We link not only to the teachers, we also go back and say, are the colleges of education doing a good job training the teachers for tomorrow and alternative certification programs? How's the new teacher project doing? How are Teach for America doing? And so, absolutely, I think there's an appropriate federal role for rigorous peer-reviewed research. I think it's something that our university researchers can help us to do. And, yeah, absolutely, I think that's something that can be done at the state and the national level. A couple of studies that I think have been critically important in this debate recently. I mean, three different ones I want to mention real quickly. Stanford's Credo Project, where they went out and measured charter schools. They actually found the charter schools in New Orleans are improving performance. That's not true everywhere in the country. Now, look, I'm not up here saying we've shut down a number of charter schools in Louisiana. Choice is great, but there have to be consequences. And if the schools don't perform, you have to be willing to shut them down or transform them or change them. Just because it says charter on the front door doesn't make it a great school. Secondly, the Harvard research showing that a great fourth grade teacher will increase the chances that your child will go to college, less likely they'll become pregnant. Third, the Hoover Institute, the Hanushek studies showing the economic impact of having a great teacher for your child, the average earning power. Those are just three examples off the top of my head where I think it was great research, great insights. I think to answer some of these other questions about the ideal class size, the use of technology, absolutely. I think there's a role for R&D. I also think that competition will take care of a lot of that as well. But absolutely, I think there's a federal role, a federal and state and local role and private sector role for R&D on those kinds of rigorous peer-reviewed, not politically driven, but rigorous peer-reviewed analytical research, especially at the university, from the universities and think tanks.
A gentleman in the fourth row, I'm going to be bipartisan here. I'm shifting to the right.
Governor Jindal, first off, as an Indian American born in Louisiana, I just wanted to congratulate you on your achievements.
Thank you.
But having said that,
there's a but.
I wanted to ask you to distinguish between, on the one hand, choice as a moral virtue, just who are you to tell me I don't have the right to send my student somewhere else, my child, and on the other hand, choice as a mechanism towards actually improving schools. It seems like we don't have much evidence on the second one of those that actually supports it. The evidence is really inconclusive, and it seems like you can just use common sense when you see failing schools being shut down and the parents are protesting like crazy to keep open this failing school. It seems like there's something wrong in that market. Natural selection is necessary for evolution, if that makes sense.
All right, I'll answer. For one, I think there is a moral imperative that it's not right that only wealthy parents get to decide where their kids go to school. I absolutely think that's true. But, again, it's kind of hard to argue moral imperatives. I will go to your second. The data is pretty clear in New Orleans. The data is pretty clear in Louisiana. Before, last year, we had a third of our kids were below grade level. We're spending $1 billion in state tax dollars, not local tax dollars, state tax dollars on failing public schools. Now, think about that. 44% of your schools are getting a D or F letter grade. We're falling farther and farther behind. Just look at what happened in New Orleans in the last 5 years. You had less than a quarter of your kids on grade level. Now you've got over the half. You had 77% in failing schools. Now you got less than a third. And the parents in New Orleans aren't protesting closing down failing schools. Surveys have shown by nonpartisan groups in New Orleans, parents overwhelmingly support the charter schools, the choice, the improvements, and the RSD. And what's happened actually surprised a lot of people, that there's actually local support for the improvements. The Bayo actually did a survey of parents whose kids are in the scholarship programs. Well over 90-95% plus of these parents support these reforms, support the choice, and want these choices. So I think the data are pretty clear that, yeah, it's working. Competition's working. Student performance is going up. The scholarship kids are doing better than their peer review. The students that didn't get the scholarships that were still in those same schools that they left behind. And they've gotten better significantly over time. So absolutely. Now, I will differentiate that from saying that I think choice as a whole works, choice as a system works. That doesn't mean that every school works. And that's why there has to be accountability. And that's why, for example, the kids in our scholarship program take the same tests as the kids in the public schools. There are consequences. You know, if the schools don't do well, they can't take new students. If they don't do well over time, we kick them out of the program. And those test results are given to parents. There's there are reams of data showing that it's working, things are getting better, and parents are supporting it. But I think it ultimately comes down to a fundamental question, and this is where I end up on that. I think you can be for choice because you are worried about economic development, because you're worried about health care costs, because you're worried about national security, because you're worried that the status quo is not working. There are a lot of reasons to be for it. But I think it ultimately comes down to this. I think parents are the best form of accountability. I think if you really want to decide what's best for a child, the parent is in the best position to make that decision. And I think giving that parent more choices is a good thing, not a bad thing, especially when you've got the accountability built in. But I think fundamentally allowing that parent to decide whether do I want my child to stay in this school or do I want my child to be able to go to another school that I couldn't afford before, yeah, I think it's a good thing. But I think the data are also very, very clear in Louisiana that it has worked. And I think it can work across the country where there's rigorous standards. Where I think it's run into trouble. And again, I go back to the Stanford study on charter schools. I think other jurisdictions need to be willing and aggressive and ready to step in and close down. You know, in New Orleans, we hold our public schools accountable. After 4 years of an F, the RSD can come in. After 3 years or a D or an F, parents can vote for the RSD to come in. But after 4 years, if the charter schools don't turn it around, they're out too. So it's not like they've got an unlimited amount of time or resources. We test and hold them accountable as well. So I think the accountability is important, but absolutely, I think choice is a moral imperative, and it's working in Louisiana.
We've done left and right, front and middle. I'm going to take the gentleman in the back here, pinkish tie. There you go.
Thank you, Governor Herb Tyson. Question about financing. Comment, please, on the local property taxes funding education and any thoughts on how addressing that inequity, and especially in the South, history of desegregation, et cetera, might bring more bipartisanship to the conversation. and also creaming?
You know, Louisiana, and I can talk from Louisiana's perspective, and then I'll talk nationally. Louisiana may be, you know, every state thinks they're different. Louisiana is a little different in that historically we've had a higher homestead exemption than other states. You know, it's something many people credit Huey Long's legacy with that. You know, we wanted to make it easier for every family to be able to be homeowners of all backgrounds. Secondly, we also, as a state, because of our natural wealth, natural resources, we do tend to fund a lot of things out of state government that a lot of other states fund locally. And so we do have this MFP. We've got this minimum foundation program. We spent over $3 billion on K-12 education as a state. Just to give you an example, in Louisiana, it's fairly protected in our budget. It takes about a two-thirds vote to cut the MFP in our legislature. We've got a formula that comes out of an elected and appointed state board of education that the legislature and the governor are not allowed to tinker with. They can either vote it up or down. They're not allowed to amend it or change it. And so that at a time, I've been governor the last 4.5 years now, let's say 5 years, state budget's been down roughly 26%. MFP funding's actually gone up in an aggregate of 9%. Per student funding's gone up a little over 6.5%, about 6 to 6.5%. So in Louisiana, anyway, there are mechanisms because the state is funding a big part, you know, of that $8,500 we're funding over $4,000 per student through the MFP. Because we're funding so much of that through this MFP formula, there is an ability to provide state resources to help provide, and the formula is weighted based on local tax base. So if a parish, you know, St. Helena is one of our poor parishes, if they got a lower tax, it's a very complicated formula, so it's hard to describe. But if they've got a lower tax capacity, property tax capacity, than a wealthier parish, like a St. Tammany parish, which is one of our wealthier parishes, relatively speaking, they'll get more MFP dollars per student from the state. So the state does have mechanisms in Louisiana to try to address some of those concerns. That doesn't mean that, I mean, I'm sure there are folks that still would like us to do even more above and beyond that, and certainly you'll continue to face those pressures. Stepping back from it nationally and looking at it from a broader perspective, I think there's a balance between two competing interests. One is, I do think that it's legitimate for communities to say we want to be able to raise and spend resources in our communities. But I also think it's, if we're truly going to allow dollars to follow the students, I think some of these district lines become less relevant. And I think we've got to be willing to let kids go across. Another practical consideration is their travel and their transportation issues once you get beyond a certain radius from where a child lives. But I do think we've got to be more willing to erase some of those imaginary lines and say, you know, if there's a great school over there, why shouldn't a student be able to go to that school just because they live in this neighborhood or this block? And I think we need to be willing to say that's okay. And I think part of allowing the dollars to follow the student is to really allow those dollars to go wherever that student, where it makes sense for that student to go to school, where that student's family wants them to go to school. That's not an excuse. I mean, I think we need to improve all of our schools. And let me be very clear. I'm not trying to excuse failing public schools. At the same time, you give choice in charter schools and scholarships and tax credits. We need to be doing everything we can to improve traditional public schools as well, which is why we did the teacher reforms. But, yeah, I think part of the consequence of choice is we got to be comfortable with dollars following the kids, even as they cross these lines that we've drawn around kids about where they can go to school.
Here. Hi. Wait for the microphone, please.
Hi, Michael Zinstein, Education Writers Association. Thanks for speaking today. My question is, Louisiana, among other states, is considering or moving toward a sort of a la carte approach to education. I don't know if that's the term you prefer, but the headlines call it a la carte. So what are the challenges? I imagine that trying to make sure that eligibility issues are recognized, having the software available to link education, the education of the student, given all the options out there. You have perhaps an online course, a voucher class program, then the brick and mortar traditional school that can get unwieldy. So as a state governor, what do you need to make that system work?
No, it's a great question. What we're doing, so folks understand, we're doing these course offerings where you still have to take at least one course at your home school, let's say, and then you can take these courses. We cap the tuition levels at a fraction, one-sixth of what the student would get, you know, the allocation per student otherwise. Now, they can do it for less. They can do it for a seventh or an eighth. Therefore, you could offer even more instruction. We've pared it down. There were dozens of applicants. We pared it down. Next year will be the first year we'll actually be operational. So this year we've taken the applications, and I think it's roughly 40, it's over 40, maybe 48 that have been selected preliminarily by BSEE, including all these public universities and other content providers. Now, for the students that are in low-income families in failing schools that don't offer these courses, the state will pay for it. For other students, they can have access to those courses, but they'll pay for it themselves. So we won't pay for it. We're, just to be clear, we're subsidizing it for those kids who otherwise wouldn't have this choice and would benefit from having this choice. I think the biggest imperative, and I think BSEE's done a good job of this, BSEE is our State Board of Education. I think the biggest imperative is to make sure, just like you do with the scholarships and just like you do with charter schools, is the accountability. To make sure that you've got quality, you make sure that you're measuring. You know, I mentioned that we're withholding half the payment till the student completes the course, and we were there. BSEE was very rigorous on the front end in terms of selecting proven content providers in terms of providing this instruction, education to our kids. So you've got to make sure the kids are actually completing the course and showing progress on the content material. And so, you know, it's great if ABC wants to come in and do a certified welding program, but you don't want it to be a fly-by-night provider that's just interested in coming in and making money. So I think the accountability, first on screening your content providers and then assessing them as they're getting paid, is extremely important. And again, I think BSEE has developed a good way to do that in Louisiana.
Here on the aisle.
Indra Klein, I have a question with regard to the state's strategy, the use of technology, primarily mobile devices for parents and their ability to be educated, but also to provide feedback. And then what is the strategy with regard to students that are incarcerated and eventually doing the transition to adults incarcerated?
Great questions. In terms of technology, one of the things our state superintendent of education said he wants to move towards digital textbooks. He has said that is something that in the future he'd like to see more and more school districts adopt. I know that various schools, my wife's got a foundation where they go around doing these smart boards, using private dollars to put smart boards in different schools and giving laptops to the teachers throughout the state. I know West Feliciana on its own has progressed, and other school districts on their own, not only West Feliciana, has progressed with a laptop initiative to give technology to all the kids in the school, so not only those that can afford it have access to that technology. In terms of the mobile devices with parents, I know some schools, I know this because my daughter's school does this, they will use their parents' the mobile devices to let the parents know in real time about test grades, about absenteeism, about other behavioral issues. So literally during the school day, we'll find out how our daughter's doing. You know, she goes to a lab school, a public lab school in Baton Rouge, and we'll find out how she's doing real time academically, which is pretty significant from when I was a kid, when you brought home the test paper and maybe forged your dad's signature if you could get away with it. I mean, you can't do that anymore when your mom's getting the email before you get home. In terms of incarcerated kids and adults, one of the changes we made in the formula was, and this is a very important point, it used to be everything was an add-on. You used to, all right, we're going to do the MFP, and then we're going to do charter schools, then we're going to do OJJ schools. Now we're allowing those dollars to follow the student. And so we're incorporating more and more of those dollars and that instruction in the main educational formula in the MFP. And that's important because it requires the same accountability standards. And that way you don't have, otherwise my concern is if you do it as an add-on, if it's an optional program, one of my concerns is you don't have the same expectation of quality, you don't have the same accountability. By putting it in the same place, by saying the dollars follow the kids and we're going to do it through the MFP, you have more of an incentive to actually get those kids back, as the ones that are appropriate, as back as quickly as possible into a mainstream educational environment instead of a separated environment where problems can get even worse. In terms of adult incarceration, that's obviously not funded through the MFP. That's a completely different set of programs. But one of the things that the Department of Corrections has done, historically in Louisiana, like in many states, when prisoners were reentering society, there was very little done to prepare them for that reentry. As a result, we had high recidivism rates. We ended up going up and relocking up the same people we'd let out of jail. And you had this awful cycle. And people don't realize the majority of folks we have locked up will be back on the streets one day. It's not that the vast majority of people are not serving life sentences. The vast majority of them are going to be back out. And so it just makes sense to invest in reentry programs. We started in northwest and southeast Louisiana, up in the Shreveport-Bossier area and in New Orleans. The Department of Corrections started these transitional reentry programs. We already had some existing programs. On top of that, for at least the last 6 months before prisoners being released, there's an intensive focus on, you know, it may be life skills, maybe GED, maybe work skills, in terms of trying to get them the education they need. And in addition to that, what we're doing upon reentry, we also have post-release programs. We have what are called adult centers. It used to be that once you were released, if you had a minor infraction, more often than not, you'd end up back in prison. And the idea behind this is to stop the minor infractions from resulting in a violation of your probation or parole terms, so that folks that have been released, they have counseling and resources available to them, so that if they get minor infractions, somebody can help them go back to work or get back in compliance so they don't end up back in prison. I'll be the first to tell you that we've made progress compared to where we were 4.5 years ago, but we're not where we need to be. And I think that's true not only in Louisiana but other states as well. I think more needs to be done. This is something that I absolutely believe a lot more needs to be done in Louisiana, a lot more needs to be done nationally on these educational programs, especially when you've got folks that are reentering society. I think it's, and you know, some people say, well, I don't look at it as being soft on anything. I think it's a great way, it's a great investment of taxpayer dollars. I think it's helping folks become productive members of society, and it's reducing crime rates. And to me, it's just, it's a smart investment and something we'd like to do more of. We've done, again, two of these in Louisiana, but the idea is to ramp it up. Ultimately, we'd like to have 9 or 10 of them across the entire state. So we're starting, but again, we've got a lot more work to do.
I hope you'll join me and